accession number 30249, Reel 8.
Gordon Rushmer, Reel 7. We ended up last time with your trip to Eritrea and the Ethiopian-Eritrean border war. After this, am I right in thinking Afghanistan would be your next?
Yes, Afghanistan next.
Right, but that was brought about, of course, by what happened on 9/11.
Yes.
And I wondered how you reacted to that as a person and as an artist, those images.
Well, I mean, that afternoon, I was in this studio painting, and a friend phoned and said, stop painting and go and look at the television. Go and watch the television. I mean, I was sitting up here and quiet in my own little world, not knowing what was happening. So I went downstairs to the lounge and switched the television on. And my son was home as well at the time. He must have been on holiday from university, I think. And I flicked the television on, and the first thing I saw was this New York skyline with this great plume of smoke. So I shouted to Andrew and said, come and have a look at this. Something big, something major has happened. And we just sat there for the next 2.5 hours with our mouths open. I mean, just amazing scenes. And then to see the second aeroplane come in live while we were sitting there, it was just unbelievable. I mean, people across the world must have just sat there. Spellbound by it, really. I mean, you don't get that good on the movies, do you? but it was quite obvious straight away that there was something. This was something very big, and very serious. You know, this wasn't an accident. This was by design. And I mean, by the end of the afternoon, I had a feeling that I was going to be in business for the rest of my life, to be honest. I mean, because I thought the Americans are not going to stand for this, and it was quite obvious from where this came. I mean, it had to be somewhere in the Middle East that had hatched a plan like that, you know. So, yeah, I did have this feeling deep down that I could have a lot of work to do over the next decade or so. And as it's turned out, it would probably be over the next 50 years, I suspect, you know. And I mean, those images are so strong, and I mean, the famous photographs of the Twin Towers and the smoke plumes, and an airliner careering in, you know, those images are going to live with everybody of our generation forever, aren't they? But for some reason, I've never wanted to paint it. There are very few things that I won't touch, but that's something I just wouldn't want to touch. I mean, I think it's probably because it's already been said. I mean, I think the coverage at the time said it all, and I don't think a painter can say anything that's going to add to it, to be honest. That's the main reason for not wanting to touch it. It's not the fact that hundreds and hundreds of people were dying that bothers me as an artist so much as the fact that it was said, it's done, it's been covered superbly by the media, so leave it well alone.
It's interesting though, you saying that, you know, where you draw the line, you mentioned this. You know, have you thought about this? And I notice with your pictures, I mean, for instance, the massacre, you know, those thousands of Ethiopians, which was done so subtly, but nonetheless you can see their dead bodies, and you've been into hospitals, and you've actually painted people who've been injured, and I'm wondering if, you know, if you ever think if this is ever a dilemma for you, Gordon, and
artistically it's a dilemma. I mean, it's more the dilemma is how you handle the situation, how you get the most out of the situation. I I can't really remember leaving a subject B because I think it's just can't paint it because it's too awful. The dilemma is how you see the awfulness, and then and how you handle it. That's the dilemma, and that's very difficult sometimes.
Mm. Yes,
because you want to be. You don't want it. Doesn't want to be too in your face. I think there are ways of putting horror over, and they're quite often. The more subtle you are, I think the more effective it can be. The more effective it is. Skeletons half hidden in the undergrowth are far more telling, probably, than a bloody rotting corpse. You know. A bloody rotting corpse is actually very difficult to paint. Doesn't make a lot of sense actually in paint. It's very, very difficult to describe in paint. But if you start there and then you treat it as a skeleton and half hidden and combine it with other images, then it starts to work. But I don't. I've never shied away from the awfulness at all, but it's just a matter of how you're handling it, and that sometimes that takes several weeks for me to work out just how I should treat something like that. It's the maximum effect.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to get. Hit people really hard with it, and that just takes a while to work out how best to do it.
Yes, I remember, you know, when we met last time, you explained so well how you want to show the other side of war, the reality of war, and I suppose it is related to that, isn't it? To get people to look at it, in a proper way.
Yes. I mean, I'm sick of seeing pools of blood and body parts in Baghdad. I mean, every day on the television, that's become the norm. Therefore, it doesn't actually. When I say I'm sick of it, I'm bored of it. Doesn't really horrify me much anymore. I'm just bored with it because it's the same old imagery all the time, and the television crew go in there, 10 minutes after an atrocity. And that's what you get. You get a mess, basically. Painter's got to do something more than that. It's got to find another way of shocking the audience. So that's why I have to give it. Well, we all have to give it a bit more thought, you know, and manipulate. You know, take that initial idea and do something more with it.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, when, you know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about this sort of compassion fatigue, because people get so used to seeing these images that they just sort of accept them.
You gloss over it, you don't see it after a while. Oh, you know, so we've lost another 100 people in a Baghdad market today, so what? Mm. You know, and we're overwhelmed with this information. I think we're fed far too much information, actually.
Do you think there's a difference? You know, it's interesting, this theme of showing these bodies and the blood of Iraqis compared to what is seen of British troops that are killed or injured.
Yes, we see nothing. We see nothing, or very little, that's happening to the British troops in the field. Very little. I mean, last night on the news, by the way, we've lost another Royal Marine in Afghanistan. The very last one-liner of the evening news. And I think that Royal Marine deserved more than that, actually. But the first item on the same news was another atrocity in Baghdad. Seems to be an imbalance there, somehow. Maybe, and I suspect the military are not wanting to release too many details, and perhaps that's right as well. I mean, you do have to think of the parents and the relatives of these young people that are being killed. So maybe in a way it's out of respect that they don't give out more information. But I still object to the fact that our fine young people are being killed in these places, and not, I don't think they're being afforded the respect that they deserve.
So you were right, weren't you? Your instinct, looking at those images of 9/11, that this was going to lead to, you know, it's an awful thing to say, but more work for you. But
yes, yes, I was delighted. No, that's an awful thing to say.
I know, you're a war artist now,
I'm a war
aren't
artist,
you?
That's
yes.
Right. Yeah. Yes, at this stage, I find I am. People are calling me a war artist anyway, even if I'm not calling myself a war artist.
So how yes. did this lead on for you? You know, did you have an opportunity to go to any of these new conflict zones?
Yes, I did. I mean, within 2 or 3 weeks of 9/11, it was quite obvious that things were starting to happen, and we suddenly found that the Americans were into Afghanistan and bombing the Taliban forces. And I deduced from that British Special Forces would have been in working with them, and that certainly I think probably within 6 weeks of 9/11 we had a lot of personnel working in Afghanistan. And then by Christmas there were all sorts of things happening. We had major deployments of special and elite forces into Afghanistan, and amongst those forces we had Royal Marines and SAS troopers and SBS guys all working together alongside the American forces. And then I followed all the news to see what was happening, and there were shots very early on of this place I'd never heard of called Bagram Air Base. And there were long shots of Royal Marines on guard at Bagram Air Base. Nobody was saying anything, but there were images of Royal Marines doing things. So I immediately took a great interest, Royal Marines being my sort of favourite subject, really. And I continued to follow the news. And then I suppose in early spring, January, February, straight out of the blue, I had a call from the RSM of the Special Boat Service in Poole. I had no warning at all. He just came on the line, introduced himself, and said maybe they'd got a little job for me if I was interested. And of course, as usual, I'm eager that I am. I said, yes, please, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, you need to come down to Poole and have a chat to us, because we've got something in mind. And by then I'd seen various special forces actions on the news coverage, and there were several major engagements, but there's one in particular. Special forces had been engaged in a week-long firefight in a fort in the north of Afghanistan near Mazar-e Sharif. And I'd hoped that maybe this is what they wanted to talk to me about, because the news coverage had been quite pretty good, and this place was obviously a spectacular location. And I just hoped and hoped that this is what they were going to talk to me about.
Did
so
you know they were special services? How, you know, would you have known that?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious from the coverage. There are a lot of Europeans in civilian clothes shooting, not in uniform.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's pretty obvious.
Yes.
These were, whether they were at that stage, whether they were SAS or SBS, or I wasn't sure who they were, but they were obviously our special forces doing a job. So I went down to Poole, and I mean, civilians don't get to talk to special forces people. It's and I think I was quite apprehensive, actually, because you think of these guys as real tough, rough, tough fellas. Well, they are, for goodness sake, you know. But I mean, working with Royal Marines was one thing, but working with special forces, that would be quite daunting. Anyway, I was ushered in to the special forces headquarters, introduced to the commanding officer, sat me down, and said, he said, "Well, we did this little job in Mazar-e Sharif just before Christmas, at a fort called Kuala Jangi, and we were wondering if you'd like to do a painting of the action." And I, well, I mean, yeah, you know, you don't think twice. Yes, please. So he said, "Well, that's great, because I've got the team next door who did the job. They're next door waiting to talk to you." So they'd all flown back by then from Afghanistan. He said, "You go and talk to them, and then we'll have another chat." He said, "This is really important because in this week-long firefight, my boys won more medals for gallantry in one action than it's never happened before in the SBS. That so many gallantry medals have been won in such a short time in one action, and we really think this is something we need to record in a major work of art." I went and talked to these guys. They were a bit shy at first. Here am I. They don't know me. I have no knowledge of the special forces. They have no knowledge of really who I am, other than, oh, he's a painter. He's thinking, you know, we're thinking of commissioning him to do a painting. And for a few minutes, they were really pretty quiet and didn't know what I needed to know, basically. You know, this guy's going to do a painting, but then they didn't really know, you know, what angle I wanted to take, you know. So I said, "Well, I don't even know what I want to ask you guys. Can you just sit me down for an hour and just tell me the story? Just tell me what happened." So they did. They talked me through this action from start to finish. And basically, this fort was being used as a prison by the Northern Alliance, and the Northern Alliance was the Afghan army commanded by General Dostum. And he's one of the warlords. Still, is one of the warlords at the moment in the north. He's an Uzbek, pretty savage fellow. But he was allied to the American forces, and they combined to push down through Afghanistan to remove the Taliban. And at that early stage, the majority of the fighting was in the north of the country, and they'd taken the city of Kunduz and Mazar-e-Sharif back from the Taliban, and taken hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, and really didn't know what to do with some of them. I mean, you know, it's a big empty country and there aren't many prisons in Afghanistan. Anyway, they'd taken about 700 or 800 prisoners from these recent battles, and they popped them in a compound in this fort. They'd taken them in one evening, and in true Afghan style, the prisoners hadn't been searched, so they were still carrying weapons under their cloaks and ammunition and grenades, you know, and they were just popped in this compound, left there for the night. And as I say, there's a vast number of prisoners guarded by about 130 Northern Alliance soldiers, so there was a serious imbalance there straight away. Well, they'd only been there overnight, and the next morning two American CIA guys turned up to interrogate these prisoners, and these two Americans walked into this compound, and started dragging out prisoners and having them kneel on the floor and put a pistol to the head, and wanted to know very crudely, really, where Osama bin Laden was. It was quite simple. It was, you know. And as soon as this interrogation started, one of the prisoners blew himself up with a grenade, committed suicide, and then all hell let loose. And they decided they were going to A, kill these two CIA operatives, and then break out. They killed one. I mean, they killed one there and then. The other American ran for it, and he got into the what ostensibly the safe side of the fort, and got on a satellite phone to his buddies and said, "Help! You know, we have a problem. These prisoners are trying to break out, and I think they've killed my mate." At that time, there was an SBS unit in Mazar-e-Sharif doing work, and they were told to go and investigate. They were the nearest sort of special boys to the fort, so they went in to have a look. And by the time they got there, the Northern Alliance guards were being overwhelmed, and there was a serious attempt at a breakout. So, I mean, this has been well documented, so I'm not going to go into it all. But this firefight ensued, and the SBS were in and out for 6 or 7 days fighting, and they called in American air support to bomb the compound, and the Americans also missed the compound and put a 2,000-pound JDAM bomb right down alongside the SBS boys. All six of them survived, just. But the Americans breached the outer wall of the fort and killed numerous Northern Alliance soldiers, and, you know, laser-guided or missile-guided bombs don't always go where they're intended to go, quite obviously, you know. But that's the American way. And eventually this breakout was put down. But out of those 700 or 800 prisoners, there were only something like 80 or 90 left alive after 6 odd days. And they were offered terms of surrender constantly. They were offered surrender terms they wouldn't accept. They were going to fight to the death, and so they did. But these boys, SBS boys, were the boys I was talking to, you know, and the real heroes. They're fantastic, you know. I mean, but so just very quiet, modest guys, but also very intelligent, very bright operators, you know. So they talked me through this business. I had a good picture by then of what had happened. They gave me a few photographs that they'd taken at the time, so at least I could see the place, you know. I was then ushered back to see the CO, and he said, "So what do you think? Do you think you can do it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do it. There's only one problem." And then I sort of took my life in my hands, really. I said, "There's only one problem. I don't think I can do it unless you take me out there." Knowing full well that, you know, British Special Forces are not going to take some little soft artist like me into a war zone. And he said, "Okay, you go home and get ready then, and we'll give you a call and let you know what we've arranged." I mean, I was beside myself. I was so thrilled to think, well, that these people are going to take me in. And then it sort of dawned on me, this is fairly serious, because the war's still going on, you know, and if we've still got special forces out there, the war's seriously still going on, you know. There are all sorts of things happening.
Well, your desire to get there, what's this genuinely artistic? Is it absolutely essential to see the terrain?
Yes, it is. It is. I see too much work produced by people who've never been into theatre. There are a lot of people who call themselves war artists who've never set foot in a war zone and have never been frightened. I think I know you get the best results by getting in there, living with the guys, eating with the guys, getting thirsty with the guys, you know, starving with the guys. If you get as close to the job as you can, then you've got a chance that you might come out with something. But also, I suppose I'm in it for the thrills as well. I mean, it's a hell of an adventure, and very few people get the opportunity to go into these places, you know. And this was worth trying on, and it worked, you know. So the SBS flew me into Kabul.
How about your preparation? You're now experienced, aren't you?
Yeah.
And you were going to do what was a very big job.
Yes.
In Afghanistan, you've been given this picture by the very, you know, the troops who were actually engaged in it. Did you alter what you took? You know, were you now experienced and you
yes.
knew what you were going to take with you this time?
Yeah, I knew exactly
Gordon,
what I was going to take.
Norman.
Gordon, yes. Yes, Gordon Rush was the name. Yeah, I had time. I mean, I had 10 days to get ready. And in those 10 days, I got a good friend of mine to make me two lovely big sketchbooks. And I have sketchbooks made that will fit down the back of my Bergen. So I slide them down, so they're made exactly to size, so they'll fit down the back of my Bergen. I mean, it makes a nice firm sort of back when you're carrying your kit anyway. So my sketchbooks are always now made to size, and I can slot them straight down, straight into the Bergen, and then I pack everything else in front. So two big sketchbooks with Fabriano watercolour paper. All my sketchbooks now have Fabriano watercolour paper.
Is that the sort of paper that you don't have to stretch? You know,
yes, I mean, it's quite heavy paper, so it doesn't cockle easily, and that's quite important. And it's got a really nice low key sort of linen-y surface to it, which just for sketching is just absolutely perfect. I don't use it for finished paintings, but it's ideal for working out of doors when you're working fast. So I took on that trip two big sketchbooks. I took two cameras, and I've learnt now you always take two cameras, because as sure as eggs, you're either going to drop one or it gets sand in it and it doesn't work. So two cameras. At that stage I was still on film rather than digital. Being a dinosaur, I've always stuck with things that worked. I'm always loath to change, you know. A bit like with the materials I use, really. I don't use acrylic paint because I think oil paint still works for me, you know, and they've been using oil paint since the beginning of time, so that's good enough for me. But yes, yeah, so I took three paintbrushes, and you can now buy little short paintbrushes that they're like propelling paintbrushes, so you can turn the handle and the brush pops out the end of this little short handle. So I have three brushes, one wash brush and two detail brushes. I have my full watercolour box. I don't stint on the colours I take, so I take a full box with, I suppose it's probably got 30 colours in it. So I mean, I see these little sketching paint boxes with about six colours in. There's no use to me whatsoever. I need all the colours, because if I take anything less, you know, what I haven't got is what I'm going to need, you know. I take a scalpel, surgical scalpel, which is useful for all sorts of things, sharpening pencils, cutting paper, scratching surface of the paper, opening packets of biscuits. I mean, scalpel's really useful. Cutting elastoplast, shaving. And what else? I'm just trying to think what else I would take. I mean, that's the basic stuff. I've learned to use my drinking water as my paint water. So I always make sure I've got two litres of drinking water, and then I've got enough water then to paint. I have a collapsible water pot, which is really useful. You can buy these little, they're like little mini accordions, really. They concertina down to nothing, and so they slip in a rucksack quite easily. But that's about it for the actual painting kit. So I travel as light as possible. I learned that very early on. You've got to take what you need, but don't take more than you need. The exception's the cameras, because cameras can go wrong. And apart from that, it's down to kit that's going to allow me to survive, basically, like the sleeping mat and the sleeping bag, and the diarrhea tablets, all that sort of stuff. You know, I always take my own first aid kit, for instance, you know, because you get cuts and grazes, you don't want to bother, you know, the medics with silly little things. So you just need to have all the bits and pieces to survive, really. Mm-hmm. A good stock of Mars pass.